Welcome, friends. This is James Corbett of CorbettReport.com and ClimateGate.tv coming to you on the 2nd of December 2011 here in Japan and the 1st of December in Western Canada, where I'm joined on the line by Dr. Tim Ball at drtimball.com. That's drtimball.com. Dr. Ball, it's always a pleasure to have you on the program. Thank you so much for joining us again today.
Well, thank you for the opportunity, and thank you for the all the work you've done in the last few years.
Well, I couldn't obviously have done it without the participation of people like yourself, and listeners and viewers out there might remember that we had a conversation back at the break of the original ClimateGate scandal in November 2009 that went up on YouTube within days of that scandal breaking, and so far has garnered, I believe, somewhere in the range of 150,000 views on YouTube, and I'd like to think was one of the videos that helped to break the dam of silence on the ClimateGate issue when it originally broke. But of course, here we are in December of 2011, 2 years later, and lo and behold, another ClimateGate release has just happened. So let's bring everyone up to date with ClimateGate 2.0 and get your take on what we've just seen.
Yeah, well, of course, the lead into it is ClimateGate 1, the original one in 2009, and it broke just before the Copenhagen Conference on Climate, actually the political conference. They're called Conference of the Parties. And it was designed or was destined to reinvigorate the Kyoto Protocol. And in order to expose what was wrong with the science on which that political policy was being based, somebody leaked the emails from the climatic research unit at the University of East Anglia. Now, that's important because the people that were working at the CRU were the main controllers, and I use that word deliberately, of the IPCC, the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change. And they particularly controlled critical chapters, the one on data with Phil Jones, the paleoclimate with Michael Mann, and the computer models with Andrew Weaver. And of course, these were the ones that established and instead of trying to disprove a hypothesis, set out to prove it. Now, and the general public said, okay, yeah, we figured, it's like they always say to me, you know, I had my suspicions, but I didn't know enough to know. But what happened was that, yes, for a majority of the people, they said, okay, we're not surprised. We figured something was afoot here. But the mainstream media never picked up on it, and in fact tried to argue that it was of little significance. And of course, by this year, it had become it continued to be a major political platform, not in terms of acknowledging that the science on which it was based was wrong, but that we had to reduce carbon and greenhouse gases and so on, when all of the leaked emails showed that the science on which that was based was absolutely wrong. But the thing had gained such a massive momentum in the political and economic arena, with the funding going to alternate energies and the whole structure and all of the funding for climate research going through government agencies only to the side that were trying to prove the thesis. And so COP parties, the Conference of Parties, were continuing. And then this year, the one was planned for Durban in South Africa. And this was a very, very important one because this was really the last chance to save Kyoto or to save a cap and trade and a carbon tax on a global basis. And because the Kyoto Protocol expires at the end of 2012. So whoever leaked the first set of emails back before the Copenhagen conference then clearly said, okay, we need to throw some more evidence into the pot. And so they released over 5,000 emails that all pointed to collusion between these people, and even more pointed to the fact that even they knew that their models were wrong and that what they were doing was wrong scientifically. But one of the phrases that shows up quite frequently, particularly with people like Michael Mann, are, you know, we're doing it wrong. It doesn't work, but it doesn't matter. It's all important for the cause. And the phrase "the cause" is really a disturbing phrase in these emails. But of course, now what effect it will have at Durban is open to debate. I think that it should be the final nail in the coffin. In fact, I think it should be, along with the release of a book by Donna LaFramboise, a Canadian, called The Delinquent Teenager, which exposes all of the problems in the IPCC, the corruption, the false information, the control of Greenpeace and the World Wildlife Fund and what they were doing. I think that that what should happen is that there should be a demand for shutting down the IPCC completely, and so this is what went on with ClimateGate 2. It was okay. The first nail didn't completely put the lid on the coffin, so here's a couple more nails with even more damaging commentary.
Exactly right, and I think it's important to point out, as you just did, that what the important thing that the emails exposed is not just that these scientists are nasty men who say things in private that they're probably embarrassed by. I think that's not so important as what it revealed about the science and the lack of science really behind so much of what we've seen. And of course, one of the famous phrases from ClimateGate 1.0 was "hide the decline," referring to the trick to hide the data in the temperature reconstruction. And I don't know if you saw, but Steve McIntyre at Climate Audit has just posted up a new "Hide the Decline" analysis, in which he's pointing out that it's worse than was originally thought. It's not just that the data was deleted from 1960 onward, but the BRIFA reconstruction was the data was deleted from 1940 onward.
Because, 1940, yeah. I saw that. And of course, the "hide the decline" was not only in terms of the graphs that they produced and hid it in there, but it was also in the and one of the things about the leaks was, now this time it didn't happen, but the first leak came out with the computer codes, and of course the computer codes are essential to understand how the computer models were programmed. The computer codes are basically the instructions you give to the computer model, where, you know, it says if this happens, then you do this. It's a series of instructions. And the "hide the decline" comment was in there, because what it told the computer was, look, if the temperature starts to go down, then you plug in data that makes it go up again. And so the computer codes, and we need to see a lot more of the computer codes, particularly we need to see all of the computer codes of the 23 computer models, ensemble models that the IPCC used to create their graph. But one of the most telling things about what McIntyre did wasn't just showing how they'd created the hockey stick and hit the decline, but what he found was that man had created a model, a computer model, that even if you threw in random numbers, it created a hockey stick. And in this newest set of leaked emails, one of the people at the CRU said, hey, McIntyre's right. I tried it. I threw random numbers into Mike's model, and I got a hockey stick. And there's even a quote there from Tom Wigley, who, of course, I've identified as the grandfather figure in all of this. He was the one that followed or took over the climatic research unit and was the father of Santer, supervised his thesis, and Phil Jones. But Wigley said, you know, it's so basic, creating the hockey stick, that even my grandchild was able to do it. And so these are some of the most telling things about it. And as I said earlier, where they are acknowledging that what they're saying in their science doesn't work. But of course, that's one of the hypocrisies. Ironically, when you read the science report of the IPCC, it tends to list the limitations of the models and the other things, but nobody looks at that because they set up the strategy that they wrote a summary which was markedly different than the science report, and the summary was released before the science report. So it meant that the media went to this event and said, oh, look, here, the temperature's going up, and they're 90% certain that it's human CO2, and they're 90% certain that the warming of the last 50 years is due to human CO2. A few people that were going and looking at the science report and saying, but hang on a minute, their science report doesn't say that at all. You just got steamrollered. And so this was another of the deceptions that they created, and it shows that it really was a PR job. Well, now these leaked emails show that they knew this, what was wrong with their own science, and they're talking about amongst themselves. And they even talk about, we've got to make sure we don't lose the PR battle. I mean, Mike Mann makes that comment in one of these emails, and so... And they're also in these emails some things that say, we really shouldn't be doing this. In other words, they knew what they were doing was wrong. And one of the debates I've had with people is, was this a pre-thought, premeditated thing, or was it just that they were incompetent? Well, my argument was, if they did it deliberately, then they're criminal. If they did it without understanding, then they're incompetent. Either way, they shouldn't be doing it. And we shouldn't be basing a policy on the whole thing. So this is these are some of the things that make this second set of emails so particularly damaging and exposing it. In other words, the evidence of the malfeasance comes from their own mouths and their own pens and their own computers, and that's what's really important about this.
Well, you touched on the possible ramifications of this release of emails for the politics of all of this, talking about the Durban Climate Conference, which is currently underway. But how about the ramifications of this release for the interface of science and the general public? Because obviously, one of the key nexuses between science and the general public in the past 20 years has been climate science, which has garnered so much attention with the global warming scare. So what does this say about what could happen or what might happen with the general public now seeing all of the shenanigans that were being played behind the scenes to try to convince the public and win the PR battle, as they call it?
Yeah, well, of course, to me, it's the classic cry wolf syndrome, that if you say that this is terrible and this is going to happen and it doesn't, and of course, that's one of the underlying evidences of that the science is wrong, because a good definition of science is the ability to predict. The first two reports that the IPCC came out with made predictions, and then they realized that their predictions were wrong, and so they changed it to, we make scenarios. Now, the media, of course, picked up those scenarios from these summaries for policymakers and then put them out in the media as if they were predictions, but the IPCC people didn't correct them on that. So, of course, if your predictions are wrong, then people start to question the validity of your science. And then if they find out that you have achieved these wrong predictions, on which very draconian measures have been taken with carbon taxes and cap and trade and the huge amounts of money lost. And when you look at the impact of alternate energies and biofuels on economies and so on, then people start to say, well, I don't believe anything you tell me. And as I say, that's the cry wolf syndrome, isn't it? Because there are issues that we need to deal with. Now, in that same vein, of course, it's what I've argued is that environmentalists have destroyed environmentalism. One of the things that they did, and this is not just the CRU people, but it's part of the cause, is that they took the moral high ground. They said that only we care about the environment, and only we care about the planet, and only we care about the children and the future. And so they did it as if to imply that the rest of us don't care. Well, that's an absolute outrage. And now you turn around and say, well, the environment, they've corrupted the whole thing. And I've got to be honest, most people didn't want to do some of the things that environmentalism required. I mean, it is a nuisance to have to sort out your garbage and to tear off the labels off the cans and all these other things. But in fact, there are some good things in it. And as I said, environmentalism was a new paradigm and a necessary paradigm. The fact that these people exploited it to push a political agenda and then use climate to do the same thing, that is, for the cause, to redistribute the wealth, it just completely undermines it. And science is in serious danger of its credibility getting as low as it is for politicians, because, of course, the one thing that all people despise above all else is hypocrisy. And if you recall, a good example of that in this debate was Al Gore, who was the champion of morality and the high ground on everybody. And then it was suddenly exposed that his carbon footprint was 20 times the U.S. average. And then when it was pointed out that Prince Charles, who was telling everybody else how to live, had 7 cars, including a Rolls Royce, well, that's the sort of thing that it just destroys it. Now, when you see that these scientists who have held the moral high ground and said, no, this is the official science, the science is settled, there's no debate here anymore, and now it turns out that they achieved that through corruption. And I know that a lot of the emails I'm getting is that other scientists are saying that climate science is dragging us all down with it. And when you look at the rigor of peer review control in other sciences compared to what went on with climate science, you can understand their concern. And so this to me is going to be a huge headache. But particularly with regard to dealing with environmental issues that do need to get dealt with.
Indeed. Well, the hypocrisy at one level, I think the immediate reaction for most people is to ridicule and mock it. It is something almost that we can laugh at. Oh, he's preaching at us with his 20 times larger than average carbon footprint and the like. But unfortunately, I think it also points to something more menacing, something that shows that this really is based on an underlying cause and has nothing to do with science, which I guess we can understand that even now as the science itself is being exposed as being based on basically fraud. I assume that means that the underlying cause that they're trying to forward here is not going to go away. So I imagine that whatever comes of the climate scare itself, I imagine that this will just manifest itself in different ways, in different pseudoscientific ideas. So what do you think might be some of the ways that this idea might continue to propagate now that the climate science idea is being exposed?
Yeah, that's very perceptive, and of course, these ideas. One of the things that's very apparent in the whole climate issue is how they kept moving the goalposts. So they would make an argument and take the moral high ground and present pseudoscience to show that supported them, and then when it was exposed, they simply, as I said, move the goalposts. The classic one, and in this latest release of emails, a fellow by the name of Yellen, Jellen, he says, I think that we should change the terminology to climate change from global warming. Well, of course, everybody was aware of that, and it occurred because in 2000, their hypothesis was suddenly not working. Not only were their predictions wrong, but suddenly the CO2 was continuing to rise, but the temperature was going down. So instead of dealing with that reality and saying, well, this means something wrong with our hypothesis and we better re-examine our models and adjust the hypothesis with what science would normally do, they might even throw out the original hypothesis and adopt what's called the null hypothesis. They didn't do that. Instead, they simply changed the terminology, and they went from global warming to climate change. And of course, climate change then allowed them to point at anything, because the climate is always changing, and point at anything and claim this was due to human activity. The underlying theme is the one that it was established. It's the extension into the 20th and 21st century of the Malthusian idea that overpopulation Malthus only looked at it in terms of the inability of food supply to maintain that larger population. But the Club of Rome in the 1970s, and Paul Ehrlich with his population bomb, and by the way, publishing articles with Paul Ehrlich was John Holdren, Obama's science czar, but the Club of Rome took this and expanded that idea that with capitalism and with industry, the technological arm of capitalism, that all of the resources of the world would be exhausted, and therefore we had to control population. Now, they chose the climate issue to shut down the industries by showing that CO2 from the byproduct of that industry was destroying the climate. That is failing. But they also, at the same time, and people can go and read about this, because all of this began with Morris Strong and the Club of Rome, and then it culminated in the Agenda 21, which was their strategy, the agenda for the 21st century. There were several people involved that got involved in it, but one of the issues that was raised at that time, and they're now going back to, they're going back to the population issue again. Al Gore's been talking about that, but also they're going back to the water resources. Now, one of the things that has been interesting in the climate thing is that all the focus is on temperature and all the focus is on warming. The reality is that cooling is a greater threat, and nobody, they didn't want to talk about that. But the other issue was precipitation. And they did talk about precipitation, but only in an offhanded way by saying, there'll be more droughts. Well, that's counterintuitive, because if the temperature of the Earth goes up, there's more evaporation, more water in the atmosphere, and therefore less droughts, not more. But if you study climate as I do, you very quickly learn that the single most devastating climate event for flora and fauna, which of course means then the survival of life on Earth, including humans, are droughts. And it was a very interesting thing, James, that in the year 2000, which was touted as the beginning of the new millennium, when it wasn't, it's really technically 2001, but in the year 2000, they asked 20 of the top meteorologists and climatologists in the States to list the 20 worst climate disasters of the 20th century. And a whole bunch of 20s in there, if you can have numerical alliteration or enumeration. But anyway, of the 20 that they listed, 11 of them were droughts. And when you look at the droughts of the 30s and then in Russia and then the ones in China, and of course droughts are really the worst thing. And so the water issue was conveniently avoided and ignored. Water vapor is 95% of the greenhouse gas, is another example. But it has always been in the background in terms of water as a resource. And one of the people that was involved with the original United Nations Environment Program was Barbara Ward. And Barbara Ward was a socialist member in Harold Wilson's government. She was the Minister of Social Services. But she got appointed to the United Nations thing, wrote a very interesting book that was an overpopulated small world, which of course relates to the Malthusian theme. But she convinced the UN that they should have an international decade of clean water and adequate sewage and sanitation. And so the water was put on the table very early as another major part of this agenda. Now, of course, the reality is, they now are talking about peak water. Now, that term, of course, is taken right from the argument about peak oil, because the argument has been made, particularly by the environmental groups, that, look, we've got to stop using oil regardless of whether it is causing climate damage, but because we're running out of oil. And of course, that has turned out to be nonsense, just as the original Malthusian argument about running out of food. But it was interesting because that peak oil idea served two very disparate groups. And of course, as somebody once said, politics makes strange bedfellows. Well, the strange bedfellows in this case were, of course, the environmentalists saying, look, we're going to run out of the oil anyway, so we might as well wean ourselves off of it onto these alternate energies. But it was a benefit to the oil companies because they would say, well, look, the nice, cheap, easy access oil is virtually gone. So you better get used to higher prices. Well, who stands to benefit from that? And now they're talking about peak water. And they're saying that we're running out of water. And René Dubois, who was working with the Club of Rome at that time, was writing about this. But the reality is we're not running out of water, that there's no shortage of water on the planet. The problem is the distribution. And Africa as a continent is a perfect example of it. Through Central Africa, in the Congo Basin and right through there, you have huge amounts, some of the highest rainfalls in the world. And then you go on each side of it. You don't go very far where you run into the Sahara Desert in the north and the Namib Kalahari Desert in the south. So Africa provides a perfect example of the inequitable distribution of water and water resources. Now, of course, if you look at the United States, you see the same thing, that the eastern part of the U.S., you run a line right down the middle, you've got over 20 inches of rainfall or plus 500 millimeters, and then west of that line, you've got less than that. But, of course, everybody wants to live in California and in Arizona and so on, but the water resources are basically inadequate to support too large a population. Now, there's all kinds of technologies that can be used to improve this. And in fact, one of the things we could talk about one day, James, is that the whole NAFTA agreement was about transferring water from Canada, which has about 30% of the world's fresh water, diverting it through massive diversion schemes down into the United States. And so the water issue, it will gradually replace the climate issue as they realize that the climate issue has been corrupted. And in their obsession, particularly these scientists, in their obsession to try and provide the evidence that their political people want. And there is a quote in these leaked emails where one of them says, look, we've got to, the government want clean, simple, dramatic answers. And it's up to us to provide them for them. That's a paraphrase of the quote, but that's essentially it. And this falls into that category that so many political leaders get into. It's like the Henry the Second thing, where he said, "Won't anybody rid me of this damn priest?" And the four thick-headed knights went down to Canterbury and slaughtered Thomas a Becket and made a martyr out of him. And of course, I'm sure Henry's sitting there saying, no, that's not what I wanted. And that's the danger when you do these things and you put ask other people to do the dirty work for you or to produce things for you. And Dostoevsky wrote a wonderful play about this in the 1930s, where he had Jesus Christ coming back to earth for the second time. And of course, he brings him back in the middle of the Spanish Inquisition, and he's wandering around saying, no, this is not what I meant. You've taken the idea and completely perverted it. And that theme, by the way, a Canadian author by the name of John Ralston Saul developed that idea in his book called Voltaire's Bastards, where he has Voltaire coming back and saying, no, that's what you created is not the age of reason that I had in mind. You completely perverted it. And of course, as always, it's summarized most pithily in that wonderful bumper sticker that says, Jesus, save me from your followers. well, obviously these people have these political ideas, and they set up this climatic research unit with scientists who were like-minded, which is what they're talking about with the cause. But of course, they then knew that the only way they could produce the science that these people wanted was to corrupt it. And they did it, and now it's been exposed, and the whole thing collapses around your ear. The other parallel, of course, is the reason that these things are called ClimateGate is because I think it was James Dellingpole that first called it that, but it was after Watergate. And it wasn't the break-ins and those sorts of criminal acts that were the problem. It was the cover-up. And so these emails are exposing the cover-up that was premeditated, planned, and very carefully worked out. And that's, of course, why leaking the information just exposes the whole thing. One of the things about it, of course, is that, first of all, people say, oh, it's a conspiracy theory, you're a conspiracy theorist. The other is that people can't believe that a small group of people like this were able to really fool the whole world. They scammed the whole world. And I think without hyperbole, it's quite fair to say this is the greatest deception in history, because unlike other ones like the South Sea Bubble and so on, this has had impact on a global basis. But as you said, they won't give up on that idea of one world government, redistribution of wealth, and control of people through the economies and the marketplace, and control of resources. But the next one will be water. Now, water is a very different issue, because water, there's a very large moral component to water. And we should talk about the different laws with regard to water, and of course the debate about whether water is a private resource or is a public good, and that sort of speaks to some of the problems with water. And of course, as Daniel Patrick Moynihan, the senator from the U.S., said, you know, you can live without love, but you can't live without water. And another side of this, by the way, is that if you had a portfolio of nothing but water stocks, that is, the recovery of water, purification of water, redistribution of water, and so on, you would have beaten the market going away over the last 20 years, because there have been conferences. There was one in Milwaukee in 1990, another one in Boston I think it was 2007, where the big money people were looking at how you can invest in water resource stocks and issues. So that the water thing has all the makings of the next agenda to achieve what they were trying to do with the climate issue.
Well, certainly, I think that's a very perceptive point. I think that the politicization of water is an increasingly important topic, and one that we've seen broached increasingly in recent years, and certainly one that I'd like to explore in greater depth with you at another time when we had the time to explore it in the depth that it deserves. But I think we can imagine that behind this PR cause that these scientists were admittedly promoting, there are a number of different ulterior motives for the promotion of this cause, from scientists who had staked their professional reputations and their careers on the idea of this catastrophic global warming, to the politicians who were interested in the idea of the formation of one world government that it afforded, to others with eugenical interests in the prescriptions of this Malthusian idea. A range of different interests, but of course one that I think the public is most easily situated or readily situated to identify is the economic aspect of it. Of course, there's a lot of money to be made from the climate change scare. And similarly, obviously, from the concept of peak water, there are vast, enormous amounts of money to be made from such an idea. So to what extent do you think that the exposure of the climate hypocrisy situates the public in a way that they're more easily able to identify that hypocrisy and to really identify the underlying aspect of this, the economic benefits that these same people who are promoting this might have in promoting that idea?
Yes, and that's right to the heart of the issue, James. Your question and observations are right to the heart of the issue. One of the most misquote, there, of course, there are many misquotes throughout our language, one of them, for example, is that power corrupts and absolute power corrupts absolutely, Lord Acton's comment. But he didn't actually say that. What he said was power tends to corrupt. And absolute power tends to corrupt, absolutely. Well, the tend modifies the whole thing, because if you say absolute power corrupts, that means everybody who gets power is corrupted. But when you say it tends to, it means that only some people become corrupted by it. And that's a very important part of it. The other is the quote, of course, from the Bible, and I can hear people, oh, here he goes with his Christian right wing and all the fun, you know, you get pigeonholed right away. But the misquote in there is that money's the root of all evil. What it actually says is the love of money. And, of course, there are various ways that the money can corrupt you. One is in just simply obtaining it for pure wealth. The other, of course, and this was a critical part of this whole process, was the money that was available through the carbon credit exchange. And, of course, Gore got involved in that. In fact, there was that famous meeting in the White House in 1997 where there was Gore and Clinton and Ken Lay of Enron and Lord Brown of British Petroleum, where they were dividing up who was going, where the carbon credits were going to be divided and who was going to get them. And Gore, by all reports, he set up a company called General Investments Management. And they didn't actually sell carbon credits, but they brokered it. And there's one report that shows that in 1 year he made $51 million out of it. But the other side of the money, from the point of view of the scientists at CRU, was that when Maurice Strong set up the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change through the United Nations Environment Program, he went to the UN to push his ideas from the Club of Rome, and he said to Elaine Dewar, when she interviewed him, she said, well, you've got these great ideas, why don't you run for politics? And he said, well, you can't do anything as a politician. I'm going to go to the UN where I can get all the money I want, not be accountable to anybody. And, of course, that's precisely what he did. Now, one of the things that everybody that I've talked to, and I've talked to people that were in school with him, that worked for him, that worked, both for him and with him, and he was a master at bureaucracies. And one of the things he did was he set up the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change through the World Meteorological Organization. Now, what that did was it gave him political control through the bureaucracies of each nation, because the appointment of people to the IPCC was then made by the weather offices in each nation. And, of course, central to that was the UK Met Office. And we see now in these leaked emails how deeply they were involved in what was going on. And of course, what it meant was that they then controlled the funding to these all of this research. And it meant that they funded only those people that were going to do research that proved the hypothesis. And of course, the massive amounts of funding that they got, when you look at the amounts of money that Michael Mann brought in that made him very attractive to the universities, and Phil Jones from the Department of Energy and so on, and the numbers are out there now about the amounts of money these guys were pulling in. Now, you can add to that, of course, the career values. Oh, well, you know, we got the Nobel Prize and we're with this and blah, blah, blah. But the funding now in Canada, for example, funding for science is done through one agency that's set up separate from government to keep it out of a political arm's length, medical research, another one, and the Social Sciences and Humanities Research Council do funding for those groups. But all of the funding for climate research went through Environment Canada. And to the Assistant Deputy Minister, Gordon McBean, who was the chair of the founding of the IPCC in Villach, Austria in 1985, before he retired as from the bureaucracy of Environment Canada, set up a a climate research funding group with $61 million of government money, and they doled out the funding on the research. So there were many ways in which the money was attractive to people, a persuasion for people, but also a career and ego booster for people. And of course, one of the things that that this became a part of, and it wasn't just climate science, and it's also part of what we talked about earlier, James, about the corruption of science. And that is that it, when I started in universities, it was publish or perish. And you got promoted and advanced on the basis of the number of publications you got. And of course, that got down to how many times your work was cited and so on. But it very quickly became how much funding are you bringing in? And of course, the reason for that was that the universities were getting some cutbacks in the recession of the 1980s, particularly. They were looking for new sources of funding. And they suddenly realized that with a reasonable argument, they could skim 35% off the top of any funding that a faculty member brought in by saying, well, look, we're providing you with space, we're providing you with heat and light and water, so we want a cut of what you're getting. And when you look at the amount of money that people like Michael Mann and Phil Jones bringing into the University of East Anglia and so on, you can see why the universities were so attracted to these people and by these people. And one of the things that at Penn State is that the president who brought in Michael Mann and set up the whitewash of what he was doing with the ClimateGate emails. He set up the whitewash investigations, and the same thing happened at the University of East Anglia. They did whitewash of these people because, of course, they were massive sources of funding for their institutions. So the money, and I hate to quote him, but Rush Limbaugh, when he says, follow the money, unfortunately, it's true. And here's the interesting thing. It isn't just true for the capitalist right wing. It's true for the socialist and the left wing. Everybody is vulnerable to it, which, of course, is why the biblical comment that it's the love of money that's the root of all evil. It's not a political statement. It's a human weakness statement. And of course, we see that throughout this whole situation.
Well, Dr. Timball, always a fascinating conversation, but I'm afraid we're going to have to leave it there for now. And I certainly look forward to having you back on the program in the future to discuss the politics of the peak water scare as we started to broach in today's conversation. But until then, perhaps you can direct people to your website and tell us a little bit about what they can find there.
Well, I started the website. I didn't want to have a website, James, because they're Frankenstein monsters. Once you've got one, you've got to keep feeding it. And if you don't feed it regularly, people very quickly stop coming back. But I'll be very blunt with you. It was the money that made me set it up, because in order to defend myself against the two lawsuits that I have, I had to get funding. And it was recommended to me that if I set up a website, but it also did, and I have a PayPal button there, but and the money goes directly to my lawyer. It doesn't come to me at all. But on the website, there's an explanation of who I am, how I plan my whole academic career around this idea about humans and their role in changing the environment, and how I got into climate science. And then a whole lot of articles about so many of these things that sadly now have come true. And as we open this conversation with the idea that there's no pleasure in I told you so, but those articles will lay out how I was telling people so.
Exactly right. So I certainly hope that people will go and check out the website at drtimball.com, drtimball.com. And if they appreciate your work and all the work that you've done over the many years now exposing this climate fraud from the very beginning, I certainly hope they will consider contributing to your legal fund because obviously the people who have a lot of money invested in this idea don't like people like yourself exposing it. So I certainly hope people will read up on that situation. But Dr. Timbal, as I said, always a fascinating conversation, and I look forward very much to our next conversation. So until then, thank you so much for taking the time to talk with us today.
Thank you very kindly.